intertextual cardboard experience.
Two episodes in a row, two prologues in a row, so my apologies for having you stuck with me for a minute before the episode starts. But if you couldn't tell by the episode's title, this is, well, A, it's going to be awesome, and B, it is a follow-up, a sequel, or perhaps even in board game terms, a standalone sequel to my last episode with Trevor Benjamin. So just keeping things consistent, and also honestly just the way that things felt and flowed for this conversation and last. So an interesting parallel there. Coming up with an audio break, having kind of that chapter sound effect, I don't know, just wasn't working. So we'll keep it consistent. So Cull Abstraction 1, well now Cull Abstraction 1, and now this, Cull Abstraction 2, the Cull Abstractioning with David Thompson, will not have the sound effects. But I have been trying to have the episode image for each episode, and this one will tie to something that happens within the episode itself. So take a look at that picture, listen to the episode, and see where it all comes together. But enough of that. It is time for the Cull Abstractioning.
Hello, and welcome to Intertextual Cardboard Experience, a podcast that is now old enough to vote, thanks in part to its excellent 18th guest, David Thompson. How are you doing today?
I'm awesome. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah. I wanted to clarify quick. I wasn't making light of voting rights by this podcast being 18. I was mostly thought of it because I've seen pictures, video, or heard you talking about Votes for Women so many times that I just wanted to just kind of give that game a shout out.
Yeah, that was one of my favorites. It was probably my favorite game of 2022, and definitely one that my daughter and I have played a lot. So we only play it. I will say we only play it co-op. We don't actually play competitive because neither of us wants to play opposition.
Yeah, but. Yeah. I think I heard you talking about that pretty recently. That's how you play it solely is through the co-op. But because I was thinking about it, a little bit of a side tangent. I mean, it's been on my radar. Everybody loves that game.
Yeah.
And previous episode or a few episodes back, I think I mentioned that where I live, the town I live in just got a new, local game store. And on my birthday, my wife took me into the game store for the first time. We were able to kind of make it out there. And it was really neat. Big fan of the store. It was just a cool place. They had really promoted, diversity, inclusivity, just, those were all the posters all in the forefront. It's kind of just making sure that everyone feels welcome. And they really kind of spotlighted a lot of, I talked to them later about some independent designers that they were in contact with, and they're really spotlighting certain games like Votes for Women. So I'm working up my store credit by selling some consignment to get that game. So
no, it's awesome. Yeah, love the game. That sounds like an amazing store. So that's really cool.
Yeah, I've only been in a few stores total, but and maybe due to the fact that it's relatively close to me, I have that bias, but it's the coolest one I've seen. So
yeah.
It's
yeah,
very
no,
nice.
It sounds great. And one thing I just thought about, and I said it was my favorite game of 2022, and that is true. My favorite game of 2023 was a game called Land and Freedom. And it just occurred to me that both, and I know this, but both of those are by first-time designers. So that's really interesting. Both great games, both designed by great people.
So, yeah. I've heard a lot about that. That's a three-player semi-co-op game.
Yeah. I mean, technically you can play it solo or two-player, but you really, I think you really want to have three players to get the full experience. And it is, It is a semi-co-op game. I'm not really a fan typically of semi-co-op, but it does it in an extremely smart way that keeps all three players in it until the very end. You know, your chances of winning might be low or extremely low, but you're in it. So it doesn't come up that issue of oh well, you know, I'm out of the game, so I'm going to throw the game that you see in some semi-co-ops. So that doesn't come up. So it's a brilliant game about the Spanish Civil War. So
Yes, that, yeah, it's definitely. I mean, I'm sure probably some of this other kind of interviews that I'd mentioned, I'd heard you talking about it, and I know that. Well, you were just on the Board Game Geek podcast with Candace Harris, and I'm not sure if you talked about it there, but I know that Candace has talked about it a couple times as well. So.
Yeah, I didn't talk about it only because we were discussing our, I think it was like our favorite historical games for new, you
Oh,
know, to get
yeah.
people into historical games, something like that. And I specifically stayed away from any game that I thought might be considered a war game, right? I was trying to go with non-war themed historical games. But if it was on the if it was there for the taking, it would have been on, you know, top of my list.
That's just me blending all the words and audio that I hear all the time, but no, that's really good stuff. That's actually kind of skip ahead, but that's a good segue because you mentioned that both of those games were by first-time designers. This is a chance for me to be wrong, but if I'm not mistaken, your first design was the For What Remains series.
Kind of. It depends on the way you look at it.
Okay.
It certainly was my first design that I worked on, but it didn't get published until much later. So that, and that's always the tricky bit. You know, I think technically my first published game was a game called Armageddon that I
Okay.
designed with Chris Marling. It was published by Queen. I think it came out in 2016. but it was designed after games like For What Remains and Undaunted and Switch and Signal and many of other games. So it's just the interesting thing with, you know, the publication schedule. Oftentimes what you design is not, you know, it's not what gets published first. And
That's
you talked, you know, obviously when you talked to Trevor, I don't think you guys actually discussed this, but you know, War Chest and Undaunted share a lot of DNA, right? And Undaunted or War Chest was specifically an effort. An intentional effort to turn Undaunted into sort of this minimalist, sort of abstract kind of game. And what's interesting is Undaunted was designed first, but War Chest was published first. So people will often like invert that. They'll kind of
Oh.
associate the two, but assume that Undaunted was inspired by the design from War Chest.
But it opposite way. So yeah,
Yeah.
so you're working on Undaunted and then wanted to make it that a little bit more minimalist. Oh,
Right.
that's very interesting too, yeah, because I mean, you know, unless people would specifically have that knowledge, I mean, it would make sense in terms of like I played this game first, then I played this one, so
Right, absolutely. No, War Chest was very much Trevor had the idea. He said, "Hey, what happens if we take Undaunted and we just strip it to its absolute core and take out the randomness of combat and that kind of stuff." So, yeah, it was definitely an intentional, you know, intent to share the DNA but push it in a new direction for sure.
yeah, I no, there's a chance I knew it, a chance I did it, but nonetheless, I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. And I, you know, I promised myself I wasn't going to call him out. I should be calling him the Grim Reaper.
That's funny. We'll get to that too. But hey, I mean that would be like a perfect anecdote of a time where he was like undaunted, too much.
Yet it was. That's exactly right. The Grim Reaper, right? We're
That's funny. But okay, so you said that For What Remains was one of the first designs that you were working on. And the reason I was just kind of thinking about that is, well, A, I mean I've played most of your games and I love them all. And I was just taking a look at your site and it was just like a little blurb on the about site that you have in it. And mentioned that your interest in playing and designing games exploded when you started working on For What Remains. So then one of my questions was then, you know, kind of what about that process or working on that game did kind of spark that passion or that explosion for you.
Yeah, so that's interesting. That game is very different than everything else I've worked on because of where it when and where it came from. So I grew up as a role-playing game guy. I did not play hobby board games as we know them. And so that was really true. Like I just played RPGs up until probably my 30s. And no, I had played a few things. So I'd played like Blood Bowl, if you know it, right? So the Games Workshop board game that uses some of the inspiration from Warhammer type stuff. And before Mage Knight the board game, there was Mage Knight the Clicks game. So like little skirmishy fighting guys that predated HeroClix, if people know what that is. And so there were very few things that you would call like tabletop games outside of the role-playing game space that were so popular that you could find them at like the stores you would go to buy comics and RPGs and stuff. But I have this vague recollection of going into a store to buy probably RPG stuff and seeing it probably was Twilight Imperium and thinking like, what is that? I don't have a clue what that is, but it looks kind of cool, but I just don't know what it is. And so I really didn't know that the world of board games even existed. But I had grown up on Japanese RPGs and stuff like so games like Final Fantasy Tactics, video games like that, or I was talking to a friend today about the game Fallout Tactics. So I didn't play Fallout 1 and 2, I played Fallout Tactics. So there was this whole like genre of video games that were like tactical turn-based games. And like I said, Blood Bowl and HeroClix and of course D&D. And so I had all these little inspirations. And so I started working on that game. And that game would eventually, many years later, become For What Remains. But this was in a time where I didn't, like I said, I didn't really know that board games existed. So at the time, I had no concept of this mashup that you see everywhere now of like this hybrid of board games and miniature skirmish games. And so that's kind of what I was working on. And then the real magic was when I got married and started having kids, and I decided that RPGs took up too much time because I was always the DM. So I was always spending all my time DM, like prepping. I was prepping for the campaign that nobody would ever see the material. That I was that guy. And so I was like, oh, this is taking way too much time. I can't spend this much time on gaming. And so I'll just, and so I, long story short, I basically found my way to board games in an attempt to reduce the amount of time I was spending in the hobby, which of course, massive backfire. Completely backfired. But what happened was, I saw that, I was introduced, and really the first type of board games I was introduced to is what we would call Ameritrash or thematic games. So obviously there was a pair, there was this tie to what I had been working on, and it was eye-opening. I was like, oh, okay. And so many years later, Evolutions, introduction to Euros and war games and hybrids and all that kind of stuff. The game that would eventually become For What Remains was informed by all that discovery. And so, yeah, I mean, eventually it adopted what most people would consider some war game concepts, right? And so that's the game that was eventually published. But yeah, it dated back to the design dated back to the mid-2000s before I even knew what board games were. So it was a very long, strange evolution of a design for sure.
Yeah, that's neat. So, I mean, just kind of like you said, having all these things that you were like, partaking in, all these board game adjacent kind of quote unquote activities, and having this design, kicking around for so long, and then it does kind of just seem like an explosion, because then after that, the number of games that you're designing and publish or getting published every year is just increasing and increasing. So.
Yeah. Well, I tell people because a lot of people ask, they're like, how do how are you able to work? And it's not like Kanizia numbers, right? Of course, because no human can achieve that. He's like a robot. But it's usually like I give myself a goal of having four games published a year. That's my goal. And I always tell people that the way I'm able to do that is basically you'll note that almost everything I design now is a co-design. And so I really don't actually do any of the work. I just pay people to put my name on it and take credit. So I don't have to actually do anything. I just get my name on everything. And I get half the royalties, which means I get like $1.50 every year. So it's great. Great.
Oh man, I haven't really designed anything outside of, kicking around ideas and stuff like that, but maybe I'll just start paying people to design my games so I can
But
throw
you and
mine
I would have a
in.
problem. That means we couldn't
Oh.
collaborate, right? One of us would actually have to do something, so we would have an issue.
It'd be some sort of like weird meta game, and people would like just some experimental piece of art.
The game is like you're two players and you're waiting for the first one to make the move and actually do the task.
A different type of semi-co-op game. Oh, well, I don't know. Maybe once I get really, I don't know if is esoteric the right word. Sometimes I say things and I don't know if it's right, but once I'm feeling that, we'll put it out there. All right,
There you
it
go.
exists. It's just not on BGG. You haven't heard of
That's right. Yeah,
it.
that's right. That's right.
Oh, that's awesome. So you mentioned that you played a lot of role playing games. Was there one that you played the most?
Yeah, I definitely grew up on D&D. Now, I mean, I played a lot of other things, so I'm 45 to give people like a sort of a sense of the time I grew up. So I grew up, it was funny, I distinctly remember when I started playing D&D, my brother, who's a year older than I, we had the second edition play Advanced Dungeons and Dragons books, core books, but the first edition Forgotten Realms module, and we didn't know that there was a difference between them. And they're really, to be honest, there's not that much of a difference. But it was funny, like as a kid looking back, how much you didn't care about things like what actual rule set you were playing with and things, right? It's like, oh, it's just a game, and it doesn't matter that there's slightly different rules and all that stuff. Like, it doesn't register. But that was the sort of time period I was growing up. Now, there were plenty of other games like there was a system called Palladium, which had a lot of warts and stuff, but it had a lot of really interesting lore. And there was a Marvel game, role playing game at that period. So I bounced around, but D&D was always the one that I would basically stick with. And I basically played Dungeons and Dragons almost nonstop from, like I said, that sort of first slash second edition AD&D through fourth edition. And then I have dabbled in fifth edition with my kids a little bit. And I love it. It's great. Just not something I do nearly as much as I used to, but yeah, the kids and I have tried it and we loved it.
Nice. Kind of a little bit of a connection to the aforementioned in the episode before this with Trevor, and he mentioned that he wishes that he had more time because there's been so many different types of role-playing games lately, things that are new systems, like longer, shorter, everywhere kind of in between. Has there been anything lately that you have been able to get into, whether it is like a different system or just like one of the shorter kind of like one-off types or?
Yeah, well, what's interesting is my kids were a little younger, so I have three kids. They're now effectively 15, 13, and 10. But when they were really young, so my girls, when they were probably like 7 and 5 or so, we played a lot of the My Little Pony game. That's what they grew up on, the My Little Pony role playing game, which is funny because I mean that's what they were interested in at the time, so that's why I got it. It was a very easy system to run. But of course, it puts me in the unenviable position of like running kids through a campaign setting that I basically know nothing about. They know everything about, and I'm expected to be the dungeon master. But we played that. Here's the funny thing about my kids. So we don't really play a whole lot of anything now, much except for my 13-year-old daughter. She'll play anything with me. But we don't play a lot of RPGs. But I would love to pick up something off the shelf, especially some of the quicker, lighter stuff, and just play that because it's just so much easier to pick up and play. But they were very much what's the word? Inspired, I guess, by Stranger Things. So they just want to play D&D because they know D&D, right? That's what they that that's the brand, right? So I mean, it's been very effective in that, and so that's what they want to play when we're able to play. So we really haven't. I did play a game called Carolina Deathcrawl. By Jason Morningstar, I believe. There's a Night Witches, very appropriate. There's a Night Witches RPG that I would love to play at some point. I think it would be awesome if Liz and I could play it, together, potentially with Jason, who was the designer of that one. That would be really cool if I could pick one to do. But I haven't actually played anything myself other than just one or two one shots every once in a while.
Nice. Yeah, I was just curious because, the you mentioned that you kind of pick games to save a little bit of time that backfired, and I was just curious where that was on your kind of like current radar and what you're doing. So nice. Okay, so I kind of skipped ahead past a I don't even know. It was meant to be a transition or introductory type of thought, but it's been brought up a couple times. And last episode, I was extremely fortunate to talk to one of your frequent co-designers in Trevor Benjamin, and I titled that episode Collabstraction. And then today's episode is going to be called Collabstraction 2, the Collabstractioning.
Yes.
Sounds
The
very
sequels,
intense.
there are some examples of sequels that are better than the original. So I'm going to tell the Grim Reaper that the next time I see him.
Well, here's the question though. But so the implication of the title is that like we're going to talk about some similar things, but not, and also kind of that idea of sequels and iterations too.
Yeah, of course.
Of
Sure.
course. And so I get to start you off on a difficult question, and you kind of almost hit it on the head, but I don't even have an answer. Most of the time, if I think of a question, I have some idea of what I would pick. But do you have any example of a movie or show that kind of mid-series or, yeah, mid-series, whether it's a show from season to season or from movie to movie, where the actor for a particular character was swapped out and they wound up being more well known or played that role better.
Well, so I mean, I can certainly there are examples of that having happened, but I can't think of any absolute major ones where like, oh, this is much better. Except now, this isn't directly answering your question because this is not like mid-series. But if we include reboots, then Battlestar Galactica has a lot of examples where like Starbuck was infinitely. I mean, nothing against Dirk Benedict, I guess I think it was his name, the actor's name, but like the new Starbuck is Starbuck, right? So I think in reboots we can come up with a lot of examples. In mid-series, I mean I would struggle to think of anything that's like a substantive example of that. That's a good question though.
Yeah, you were like right on it right away. You had that thought. Like I said, I came up with the question and I had nothing.
I thought you were going to ask. I thought you were going to ask, a series that sort of evolved such that it got better as it went on, or something like that, right? And I'll just quickly note, for people listening that might be interested, I watched The Expanse, but I did not watch it like all at once. And when I first started, I have not read the books, so I should admit say that this is from a guy who has not read the books, but I just wasn't into the show that much, and I don't watch a ton of TV. So it took me a long time, but I did kind of like push through the seasons eventually until we got to like season 5 and 6. And whoa, boy, they're really good. Really good. So, if we could talk about this series in this, and of course, there's Star Trek Next Generation. There's so many examples of like, it's a show that takes a season or two to get its footing under it. But yeah.
Yeah, that's funny. I've heard a good number of people speak highly of The Expanse, but I don't necessarily know if they have that same sentiment or if they thought it was good from the beginning, though. I guess
Yeah,
that's
I'm not sure. A lot of people liked it from the beginning, especially if they liked the book. It was sort of like the focus of the show, especially when it hit season 5, that really it got a little bit more into like sort of the military political stuff and a little less about the whatever you call it, the MacGuffin of the show with the protomolecule that was sort of the underpinning of the concept that I didn't care as much about. So, but that, so that sort of like focus, it shifted, and I was on board for that.
Nice. Yeah, I definitely, I mean, I go through kind of like, peaks and valleys for most of my hobbies, whether it's, board games or video games or shows or movies. But that's why I created this podcast, so I can bring up random stuff whenever I feel like it. So
You can do whatever you want.
I can.
The beauty of podcasts.
Exactly. And just giving it a name like Intertextual Cardboard Experience just gives it like the easiest catch-all of all time. So awesome. Okay. Well, I've got a not too many questions, kind of like a couple similar collaboration questions, and then a little bit more open-ended one. So you brought up the title or the name that Trevor and I work towards for him, that could best define his particular role in a collaborative team, partnership group, trio at most, or what have you. And that was the Grim Reaper. So your task is to come up with yours.
Oh boy. I should have expected this. I should have been prepared. So, okay, let's talk a little bit since, we're talking about collaboration, right? So sort of an extension of last episode. And let's put some context to my collaboration. So obviously Trevor talked a lot about me and a lot about Brett, right? And I think this is true. We're the only two people he's has published games with. He's worked with other people, but as for, in terms of published games, I think we're the only two. For me, I've worked with a lot of other people, many of which I only have, like, say, one or two games with. But there are, so Trevor is the person I've worked with the most. And then a person, probably the person I've worked with the second most at this point now is Roger Tankersley, right? So we work alongside Trevor on Resist and Witchcraft, and we've got some other things cooking. But Roger and I also worked on a game called Sniper Elite. And we have another game with a publisher that's on the way, et cetera. So Roger's probably the second person that I've worked with the most. And then Liz and I don't even have a game out together, but we've been working a lot together. And one thing that is true about all three of those relationships that's different than some of my other design partnerships is with all three of them. It's a little bit not sure about Trevor, but Roger and Liz especially, I was friends with before we designed anything, like very good friends with them. And so our collaborations come from a place of friendship first, collaborative game design second. And so that was a lot of like talking, background material to get my point here. So my point is this. Let's just say there's a hypothetical spectrum where one end of the spectrum is like minimalism and abstraction. And then on the other end of the spectrum is like willingness to have more complexity or more just stuff in the game, more chrome, whatever you want to call it, whatever word you want to call it, and less concern about minimalism. And so I would put Brett on the far end of the abstraction, and then I would put Trevor next, and I'll remove myself for a moment, and then I would put like Roger and Liz probably further on the direction of complexity. And so I think I would fall in the middle of those people on that spectrum. And so I'll give myself the title of middleman.
Okay. I like that.
Yeah.
That makes
Yeah.
us
Trevor, it's funny because Trevor had a very similar response, and he talked about the same thing. Like your roles change depending on your design partnership. And certainly, he goes from being the person who's less minimalistic and less abstract with his partnership with Brett. And then he takes on that role with me. And I have the exact same sort of dynamic when I work with him versus when I work with Roger versus when I work with Liz. In each case, I take on different roles. Sometimes those are roles that he would normally take on, just depending on the relationship and the dynamic.
Okay. Huh. Okay. Well, that sounds, I mean, that's fantastic. I mean, the story behind it, or not the story, just like the explanation makes a ton of sense. And I like the name. You came to it really quickly. But honestly, I don't know what sparked this question in my head, but you kind of put the you handful of designers on that spectrum. And I don't, like I said, I don't know why I came up with this question, but it's here. So what type of game do you feel like you would be least likely to design? This is a part one of a part two.
Yeah. Well, I would never design the kind of game I don't want to play. So we can talk about the kind of games I don't like, which because I would never design that, right? The least kind of game. I mean, like the kind of game I would be the least likely to design would be like a take that kind of game, which I can't deal with. I don't mind games that have randomness or uncertainty. I make a lot of games that have like output randomness with dice rolling and stuff. That's fine. What I don't like, there are games that have like, for example, quote unquote adventure game where you're going around and you do something, and you draw from a deck of cards and you do a thing that's very impactful to you that you had zero agency over, right? So anything like that is a very big like turn off to me. But I would just say like any sort of like take that kind of game is not my wheelhouse. I would never design something like that.
Well then, okay, so then you get a follow-up before the other follow-up, and that's that. What's a type of game that you do like that, at least at this point in time, you don't feel like you've designed in that space or really haven't thought about designing yet?
Yeah. So, I absolutely wish I had the ability to design games like, have you played Prey Another Day? Do you know this game? It's,
So I did just see
you see my
the
post?
picture
Yeah.
very recently, and it's funny because I'd heard it on, I think it was brought up briefly on the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast,
Okay.
but I from what I recall, I didn't get, I'm not sure how much they talked about it over, like it seemed like they were positive on it from that. From that podcast, but I just didn't get like a ton of sense, so I didn't look into it a ton more. But then after I saw your picture, I went on to the site that I buy games most from, and it was currently out of stock, so
Yeah, of
that's
course, of course. So, I would say it's like from similar to like the Kanizia School of Design. So it was designed by Brett, who we've already talked about, Trevor's often partner. And Brett's other, I mean, this gets, we talked, you talked about this. You talked about the Cambridge cabal and how incestuous we all are. But it was Matt, it was Brett and Matt Dunstan who worked on it. And so it's an extremely simple, dirt simple game. I won't go into detail here, but it's like a 5-10 minute game. As the second I introduced my kids and my wife, who doesn't really play games, to it, we played like, I don't know, 8 times in a row. They took it. I was sick, unfortunately, and I missed our favorite vacation of the year is called Weekend Werewolf, where we go to this castle in like the hills of Ohio and play a weekend long game of werewolf, like 60 people. So I was sick and missed it, unfortunately, but they took that game and they introduced it to my people. And I took it to a historical game convention and taught this not historical game to a bunch of people. So anyway, the point is, I'm not capable of making those kind of games, right? So, and what I mean by that is like these extremely minimal, smart, games like a Kanizia style or whatever. I've tried, it's just not my thing. I have to start from a place of like a game that's about an event or about a concept, about an experience, and then just build from that. I can't have this clever, like, oh, I'm gonna have a deck of cards 1 to 5, and we're gonna go down the list. It's super abstract. Just I don't have that capability. So I would absolutely love to. When Brett and Trevor finally get their mass market game published and they're rolling in their millions of dollars and stuff, and I'm, their game's on sale at Target, Walmart, and I'm at home working on my hyper historical military war game or something that's going to sell 12 copies, I'll just lament the fact that I don't have those skills.
or you could just pay them to put your name on their
That's
next
right.
design.
Yes, that's right. That's right. I do have those skills. At least I have the skills to get my name on the box. So.
That's funny. Okay, well, man, that's all good stuff, and honestly, yeah, knocked out all my. That wasn't something I'd been thinking before, but it just popped up, and that's neat. Yeah, so the long and short of, I definitely have that game on my radar, and I hope to play it very soon too. So.
Well, and you know, I mean, you talked to Trevor about it, but like similarly, his games with Brett, Mandala, Patterns, I'm sure Flowers when it comes out. I mean, they're brilliant. They're brilliant. And I feel so bad. I have an entire shelf. I don't, you might be able to make it out. It's right there. So the people listening have no idea what I'm talking about, but I'm pointing to my shelf and I have a shelf dedicated to games that Brett and Matt have, or Trevor and Brett have designed. And for some reason, I don't know why, I have like every one of the games they've ever made, except I didn't have Mandala. And I got it and I played it once with my daughter, the only person in the world to play games with me. And we liked it. It was fine. We played it once and then something happened. We put it up and we didn't play it. And like literally a year later or something, we have this weekly thing where she and I will go to the coffee shop together and we'll play games. And we usually play similar things for a while. And I was like, I want to play something different. And so I picked it up and we took it and we played. And I was like, and I never do this. I was like, we're just going to learn it from the rule book. And so we did. We learned it from the rule book at the coffee shop and we played it. And I think we wound up playing like four games of it, maybe five games of it that day. And then I immediately went and bought Patterns. And we've been playing, I think that was very late last year or early this year. And we played Mandala and Patterns, other than Pray Another Day, those have been by far the games we've played the most. And that was the only reason I bring that up is because I think it falls into that camp. I would struggle to design a game like that because nothing against Mandala and Patterns, but they're not exactly like steeped in the historical, you know, or thematic underpin. Like it's a very abstract kind of game, right? So.
Yeah, I have a follow-up thought to Mandala, and I've kind of been thinking about my conversation with Trevor, you know, just having it, listening back to it a couple of times, and coincidentally enough, I don't know when, but honestly, it was probably within the last couple or few weeks at most, but Mandala was released on Board Game Arena.
Okay.
And I mean, I usually will play a few games, maybe a handful most at once on Board Game Arena asynchronously. And well, first off, I would never play that game asynchronously. I think I'd go crazy. But occasionally, especially if I see or if I click in to start a game and I have, you know, 10, 15 minutes, it's a pretty fast game. I just wanted to try it out because I love that game and I wanted to just play it more. And it was good. Implementation was good. It was fun. I had a good time. But some of the things that you know, I you know was talking about that I felt when playing it, just some of that, a good bit of that above the board tension, definitely didn't like exist. You know, just kind of, you know, that feel of. It kind of got more into just like, you know, clicking and playing what I thought would work the best, but it just didn't have like, oh, I really hope they don't go there with this. You can't see the cards in your hands. There's just, I mean, I like Board Game Arena. I'll play games on Board Game Arena, but I don't know. I don't know where I'm getting at it, but
No, that's a really interesting observation. And I think we played, my daughter and I actually played Patterns last this past week, when we went, we did our little weekly coffee shop date. And it's a similar thing because when we were playing Patterns, the first game we played, it was kind of a slow thinky game. And then the next game I was just like light, I was just doing like lightning fast moves. And that wouldn't translate in BGA, right? But you could do it in real life. And like for some reason, the way in which the players are playing the game, there's like this weird circular feedback between the players and the way they're playing it together. And that you know, you just know that would never translate to the to BGA, right? It doesn't make a difference how you're approaching it. And so yeah, certainly I don't play a lot on BGA. I mean, I think it's cool that it exists. I don't really play a lot online at all. But you do miss a lot, right? Obviously.
Yeah, and that's probably why I play most of my games asynchronously with, you know, friends, just so we can hop on and send a message once a day, play a turn or whatever. And it's nice. Yeah, I not my preferred way either, but glad it exists. And yeah, I mean, I know I'll keep playing games of like Mandala on it, but once I get to play against someone else and really kind of like sink into that game with them. It has, like you said, kind of that flow-ish feel and those different feedback loops as you mentioned. Cool. So, the other kind of question that I'm taking and iterating, changing a little bit. Wasn't when I asked about the kind of collaborative like failure, I wasn't trying to get any tea or hot goss or anything like that. So I took that question and I tweaked it though. All right. So
Meaning, just to be clear, the meaning when you asked Trevor last time, right?
yes,
Yeah,
yeah,
okay.
yeah. So
I
I
knew what he
asked.
and it was funny because I knew exactly what he was talking about. I was like, oh, that's a very, very real specific example that I know all about. I was part of
Hey,
that.
so it means something very specific to you and something very general, but also providing a lesson to everybody. And yeah, just on like he said at the end of it in a very profound way that it just applies to all collaborative elements. Like you just kind of got to be all on board with each other, and that's very true. But so I took that question and I'm tweaking it to what's the I have the word funniest, but I guess you could replace that word with something else. What's the funniest moment that came from a collaborative miscommunication?
Oh man. Oh, I don't know. Let's think about this for a second. Oh man. I was ill prepared for this. Oh, I don't know. I can't think of any funny, especially.
Okay, I'll see if I can
Oh, yeah, I'm failing you. I'm sorry.
No, I like I said, I knew when I put the word funniest, I don't know. Like you it I guess it doesn't have to be like ha ha humor, but more maybe like just some like series of like unfortunate things that happened that weren't like catastrophic, I guess. That you can look back on and laugh at, I guess.
Oh goodness. What could that be? Well, I mean, okay. So first of all, I'm trying to decide whether or not I should go back to Trevor's example and expand on a couple of things because I think there's some interesting like so for people who didn't listen to it, you should go back to listen to that. Make sure you listen to that first, right? But I think what's interesting is Trevor gave an example of quote unquote failure, but the game went on to exist and was fine. Our part of the design didn't get completed. And one thing that I think is really important to come away from that is it's important to know like what you want to do when you're designing a game, what you want your role to be and be true to that. And that was, you know how you always hear this is like a such a cliche saying about, oh, you'll hear this in like when people are making movies together and like one person will leave or whatever. They're like, oh, we left over creative differences. And you're like, oh yeah, right. They like had a fight and somebody left or whatever. Somebody got fired basically. And they're saving face. In this case, it really legitimately was like, everybody's a good intentioned person. Everybody's awesome. We're coming from different perspectives. We genuinely did have creative differences. And eventually we were like, oh, this isn't going to work out. Everybody's awesome. We leave on great terms. And the project went on to succeed. It's just that we didn't continue with it. So I think it's important to understand that like there is a time where you should stay true to yourself more than anything else and say, this is probably the time that we should, step away. So that's not the answer to your question though. So I'm gonna, this isn't really funny. I'll just tell a little story about me and the Grim Reaper. And it's like our origin story, right? So like Trevor talked about, we're all from the Cambridge School of Design or whatever we call ourselves. And I think the very first thing we started really working on was probably what it would eventually become Undaunted. But also early on, I came to the design meetup. And so what would happen is, like, I think it was every Tuesday night or something, we would all meet in Cambridge at a pub, and we would all bring our own stuff. And you have this dance that designers do at playtest meetups where, like, everybody really wants to play their game, but you also have to play everybody else's game, right? Like, that's the price of admission. And so I wanted to make a game about American football, like, basically, like, management, right? So, like, a game that simulates, like, not like playing football, but like managing the players and, like, super quick, like, game resolution, maybe. But really, I wanted to have, like, players that would age from season to season and get better and then get worse, and you have to pay them and all that kind of stuff. That's what I wanted to make. And I came to it with that idea, and Trevor's like, oh, let's work on this together. And that game eventually became what was published as Orc Olympics, which
Oh.
is like one of our other. I think it was our first design together that was published. And so what happened was, over time, it evolved into this completely different game, very different theme, et cetera, et cetera. And if certainly if we were working on it now, neither one of us would ever let that game have been published in the state it was. It's fine. It's okay. It's an okay game. It's not, but it's not great. And it's an example, I think, of two people getting to know each other, getting to, and I told you, I was friends with Liz first, and I was friends with Roger first, and I knew all about them. And Trevor and I didn't. We got to know each other through designing, and that game represents a time in our relationship where we were getting to know each other. You don't have the, it's not the word, right word is not trust, but, like, we couldn't be probably as open as we might could have been or should have been when we were giving each other feedback and, like, being honest about what's really important to me in this design and what's not important to me in this design and where you're willing to compromise and stuff. And so I think in this, in the end, you wind up having a game that's probably, it is our worst game, right, that we've made. And it's also, I mean, I'm not saying, obviously, we were just getting started, so it's all forgivable and stuff. But in terms of, like, a game where there was a series of whatever you want to call that, unfortunate incidents or whatever, I would just say it's a game that was made of its time and place. And it's funny to look back on now and sort of smile at what it was originally conceived as, what it eventually became, and just how it represents the early part of our relationship.
Nice. So I've seen that game just on your BGG page. Do you feel like it has any similar DNA to any of your other games, or is it just?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it's probably kind of its own thing. I think it really is. It doesn't share, it's kind of this weird auction drafting game, which doesn't really fit anywhere, at least anything I've worked on, and I don't think anything Trevor does e has either. I don't really think it shares much DNA with anything else. Probably for the best. No, it's not bad. I shouldn't mess with it. But no, I think it does kind of stand. And I don't mean this in any way disrespectful. I think Armageddon sits in a similar place, and I think Chris Marling would attest to that. That, like, it was very early for both of us, and there's a lot of regrets we have about that game. Not as much on the design, but on the relationship and the way that the development for that game unfolded, and us not being active in that and kind of not being happy with where it got to and stuff. And so I don't dwell on, like, what could have been and wanting to go back and change games and that kind of stuff. But certainly, when you look back at some games, you do wish that things had played out slightly different in some cases.
Yeah, that I mean that's really interesting. I mean, I think, part of kind of my well, I having these conversations is just fun for me in the first place, but it's really nice just getting to learn and hopefully having other people like get to hear. I mean, you mentioned it, a couple other people that I've talked to mention it about like when the design happens as opposed to the publication of the game. Like that's one thing that I mean, I would assume most people would think that there's some time period, but to the point where like the release could get so flip-flopped that people think that the one inspires the other. And just kind of how, especially with you working on a lot of collaborations and how the collaborations between designers and the collaborations between designers and publishers and artists and all these other things, and how different that can be just from like time to time and just in time of your life as well. Like, I think, yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, most people get the game and their reactions are to the game, but there's obviously a whole bunch of stories that are wrapped up into it, especially, the more people you get involved, so.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So every game was made by people, and every one of those people that helped make that game had some sort of relationship along the way, right? And I would guess that if you were to do like a deconstruction of a game, and it was a very good game, and you looked at it and you did this, deconstruction, the relationships between the people who made the game were probably strong. And there was probably close bonds. We approach Undaunted designs now very differently than we did when we first started. We're much more intentional at the very beginning of a new Undaunted to bring in when we started on the most recent one in the virtual chat or whatever. It was myself and Trevor. It was the entire development team, so three people. It was the artist. It was the graphic designer. And it was the author who, like for example, in Stalingrad, there's a lot of text that was written to accompany that, and that was written by an author they brought in. So before we ever actually started the first any design work, we all came together and talked about the project, right? And now, of course, you don't always have that opportunity, and of course, it's a game that's built on a system that's been very successful, and et cetera, so you want to make sure it's as good as possible. But the point is, right, I think that that game, people will never know, but I think that that game will benefit from the deliberate relationships that have been built up over time to try to make it the best possible game it can be.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And just kind of along those lines too. I mean, you, Trevor, talked about it. You're talking about it, how, you're designing with Liz and Roger, who you'd been friends with, and now Trevor has been a fantastic friend for all the time since you started designing together too. And I think, I mean, it seems obvious, but like, I would assume that there aren't going, especially in the board gaming designing space, too many collaborations that are going to be linked to just relationships that aren't like the greatest.
Yeah, I think, I mean, so to be full disclosure, I've worked on all, I've experienced the range, right? And the range being everything from literally my best friends in the world, Trevor, Roger, Liz, et cetera, that I also design with, to collaborations with people who I would consider friends or acquaintances that I have a really good relationship, right? So like Jeff Engelstein and I are working on a game right now. Jeff and I know each other. We don't have the same relationship that I have with everybody else, but it's certainly a positive, good relationship. It's just much more, it's not like business-like, but you know what I mean. It's just a different, positive but different relationship. I've had experiences where I worked together with a person, and we would maybe even there was a game out of it, but you're like, I don't know that I necessarily need to go back and work with that person again. And then you have like, that did not work out. We're not doing that again. I mean, it can run the gamut, right? And I would just say I'm very blessed that I've had way more of those friendly, positive experiences. But I mean, occasionally you do, and you do have not such great, experiences. And the thing is, it's not that there's a bad person in that. It's just that you're going to eventually come along when you work with enough people, you're going to come along and you're like, well, there wasn't as much synergy there, right? And I think it's important to recognize that and say, especially when it's not your job, right? If it's your job, there's a difference. Like if I'm trying to put, food on the plates of my children, then there's a different driver than if it's, something I'm doing as a sort of whatever, jobby, as Trevor called it. So, yeah, anyway, that was a tangent, but the point is it runs those relationships can run the spectrum for sure, and they have.
Oh, and it's nice now too, especially with some of the newer design partners that you've had too, like you mentioned Jeff and and Liz and designing more with Liz already, Night Witch is still coming out soon, and then all those other games that you're already working on. So just being able to, like, now kind of have that group. So no matter what your if your goal is to kind of get, like about four games out a year or whatever, I mean, you're having like those four people that you design with, that's it's going to happen. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. And one thing I would mention that I don't want to get lost in the shuffle about collaborations, and I don't think Trevor mentioned this, so I want to mention it, is for me personally, and I think this is probably true for other people too, having a design partner is a really, really, really good way to hold yourself accountable. So when I meet with any of them, Roger, Liz, Trevor, whoever, we will come together, and especially with the three of them, this I work the same way with all three of them. When we do almost all of our design work together. We don't do this thing where, like, we'll come together and talk a little bit and then go away and do a bunch of independent design work and then come back together and compare. We don't do that much. When Trevor, Roger, and I work together, it's a little, Trevor talked about this, a three-person dynamic's different. And so we do a little bit more of that then. But when typically with co-designs, with the three of them, we'll come together, we'll do all of our design work together. And the only thing we'll do independently when we go away is like action-oriented, task-oriented things that aren't design work. So like Liz will write the rules and I'll make stuff for Tabletop Simulator or whatever. I think that's super important. But the other thing we also do is we always set the next meeting schedule and the tasks for the next meeting. And I can't screw that up. I can't not do that because I'm letting somebody else down, not just myself. And that's very different between that and, like, I have a few things that I'm working on that are like, what I would call like my indulgent designs, right? So things that I would like to be working on, but they are so far down the list that I seldom have time. And the reason that they're not getting done is because I don't have to, I'm not being held accountable by my partnership with anybody else to get them done. So I just wanted to flag that as another practical benefit of co-designs, is that accountability.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense too. So, I mean, not necessarily in a negative way either, but you mentioned that maybe some of your kind of like solo, more indulgent things that you have been working on may get bumped down, just so you can not let your partners down. Do you feel like, I mean, outside of that, what sort of kind of what has the change been, and what has been your approach in some of your solo designs? So, I mean, we talked about For What Remains, and you've done the Valiant Defense series, which four games, or is there a
Four
part?
games so far. A fifth one's coming out, but the fifth one won't be designed by me. It's being designed by
Oh
somebody
yeah.
different in the system.
So yeah, so a bunch of those games that, yeah, I guess back to the kind of the question is like, what sort of changes have you seen in your soul design based on just designing more in general, designing with other people more? What has that brought about?
I used to say that, and this was probably about 3 or 4 years ago. I used to say, when people would talk to me about designs, that, I basically do co-designs when it's a multiplayer game, and a lot of my solo game designs were solo games. There's a lot of obvious practical reasons for that. But that slowly changed in the Valiant Defense series that you mentioned as part of that evolution. So the first game in that series was called Castle Litter, and then there was a game called Pavlov's House. In the third game, it's called Soldiers in Postmen's Uniforms. There's a co-designer listed for it, Michael Kochman. And so Michael was actually the person who had reached out and proposed the topic. He's from Poland, and the game is set in Poland during World War II. And Michael was a game is a gamer, but he's also, he's there. He lives there. I actually went, my wife and I actually traveled to Gdansk, or at the time when the game was set, Danzig. And we met with Michael, and he and I did a bunch of research in person together there. And so he served essentially as like a cultural con or a historical consultant, if you will, is probably the most accurate way to describe his role in the game. But I felt, but I mean, I always ran all the design stuff by him, but I felt like his work, he deserved co-design credits. And the similar thing happened with a game I designed about stealth, a solo game I designed called By Stealth and Sea with another designer, Nicola Seguini. And so it was during that time period where I had these positive interactions with people doing this sort of like hybrid historical research slash consulting slash co-design work with me. And I was like, you know, even with my solitaire designs, I'm enjoying this way more collaborating with people. And so it just sort of like organically evolved over time that I realized, like, even with my solo designs, I would prefer to just work with other people. To the point now where I don't know, truthfully, if I'll ever do another game that I would list myself on the box as the only designer. Maybe someday. I won't say never, right? But all of those games, even the train game I made, Switch and Signal, which is listed as it is a code, I mean it is a solo design, but it dated back to like 2014, right? Like before I was really even collaborating with people. And so I just don't think I have enough time in the day now to work on stuff by myself. I think I would always work with somebody else on it.
Oh, that's really cool too. I mean, like you said, it just seems like it was that evolution too, kind of picking up more people who were interested in the history that matched the Valiant Defense series. That's really neat. Okay. Well, so you talked about it a little bit before, kind of thinking about, collaboration and abstraction. A little bit, and you mentioned that on the spectrum, the kind of like mandala or pray another day, that's not where you can get to. So on, I guess, the opposite end, you brought up the word chrome before, and I mean, I'm definitely not the most historical based gamer. I have enough, and I like them a lot, but chrome here. If I'm getting it wrong, meaning, rules kind of created for a particular history or a detail. Okay.
Yep, that's exactly right. Yeah, it is kind of a wargamey term. I think people might call it like crunchy or rules grid or whatever. There's a lot of millions of terms for it, but it basically, in the war game parlance, a chrome or like a chrome rule or whatever is a rule or rules or subsystem or whatever that exists essentially to usually simulate some sort of historical element in the game, right?
So then thinking about that spectrum, which of your more historical based games do you feel is the chromiest?
Oh, that's a good question. Oh, man. I can give some examples of current. So this is really difficult, right? So let me can indulge me for a moment and let's just have a little tangent about Chrome rules. So I think it's important that before you start a design, so the way I design historical games is I'll read all about the event. I'll take a bunch of notes. Usually there's like a 6 month research process before I start the design. So I'll research, I do a bunch of research, take a bunch of notes. I'll sketch out this sort of like conceptual model of what the game should be like. And when I'm doing that, I'll take notes of like, okay, this has to exist in the game. This has to exist in the game. And I'll make the okay, these things have to be there. They just have to. And then I'll start designing the game around that. And it's important at that point when I'm making those this has to exist notes that I know who I'm designing the game for. Who's the audience for this game? So the reason that's important is if it's a game like an Undaunted, where it's for a broader hobby, broader audience, then it can't have those Chrome rules. Like it just your my quote unquote Chrome budget is really low. Okay. If it's a solo war game in the Valiant Defense series, my quote unquote Chrome budget just skyrockets because I'm dealing with the vast majority of the audience is going to be solitaire war gamers. They are a lot more forgiving for that kind of stuff, right? So before I do anything, I know this is who I'm designing it for. This is my Chrome budget. This is what I can afford to include. Okay. So I'll answer your question. I don't know. It's probably like Pavlov's House or By Stealth and See, something like that. That's probably. But I want to give a couple of examples, and I want to walk through why you make those choices about whether you should or shouldn't include them. So the last game that I worked on in the Valiant Defense, and we should just real quick, the Valiant Defense series. This is a series of solo war games published by Danversen Games. All the games share the common theme of you're a small group of people in a sort of like against all odds, hopeless defense kind of situation. So that's what all of them, and they're all real historical events. And some of them are like so bizarre that if I told you what they were about and you would be like, that's not true. That's not real. And I would like, nope, these are all true historical things. So the most recent one is called Lanzerith Ridge. It's on the first day of the Battle of the Bulge, and there's this group of like 20 US soldiers. They're not even real, like a normal infantry unit. They're like a scout unit that's designed to do reconnaissance, and they're pushed into a situation where they're forced to take a more conventional role, to plug a gap in a line, blah, blah, blah. And a German unit of about 500 soldiers comes upon them, and they hold the Americans hold that group of 500 soldiers off for basically a day. So 20 guys hold off 500. That's a really oversimplification. The Germans were at this point in the war not very well trained, and the officers were horrible, et cetera, but they did hold them off. Okay. In the game, in the reality, those 20 American soldiers had a few machine guns. They had a couple of different types of machine guns. They had a few different positions where they were. And those few machine guns were the reason ultimately that the Americans were able to hold them off. So they had to exist in the game specifically. And it was important to, in this case, model ammunition. Now, that's not something I've ever done in any other game. It's probably something I'll never do again. But I needed the idea of ammunition as a finite resource in order to model effectively the reality of the situation and to give that same sense of like the stress of saying like we only have so much, so we can only hold out so long. So creating that system for that game, for that version of that game, and that in the Valiant Defense series was a decision I made because it was so important. So it's not often that I would make a game that has individual machine guns and you're actually, you're not tracking each individual round, but you know what I mean. There is a finite amount of ammunition that you have to track. So that's an example. I mean, there's others, but if you said I absolutely had to, I would say probably Pavlov's House or By Stealth and See has the most chromey bits.
Okay. Nice. Yeah, so from the I own those four games that you've designed in the Valiant Defense series, and I played three of them. So the only one I haven't played yet is Lanzerith Ridge. But
Okay.
no, I it's okay, here. So here's a follow-up question then too, based on that, because I know that you said this that you put in at least kind of a 6 month period of research before you start on it. And then you also make a companion guide. Is that the right
Yeah, that's right.
for each of them? And how long does creating that take?
Oh goodness. Few months. Yeah. When I'm probably for a Valiant Defense game or a game like that, like an actual historical game, not something like Undaunted that's set in a historical period, but an actual historical game seeking to model a historical event or events, I usually spend 6 months to a year researching it, and then probably 3-ish months working on the companion book.
Nice.
Yeah.
Neat. Okay. Well,
We should we but real quick before we
Yeah.
leave Valiant Defense, we should do an entire episode on just Castellitter and blow everybody's mind based on what it's about. Like it's the most mind-blowing thing that happened in World War II, I would submit. So it's just a, for people that are listening, just do me a favor, go Google Castellitter is ITTER and read about the insanity of what happened there. So you'll be happy you did.
Maybe, well, oh, here. I mean, I know that I'm ill-equipped to talk about so many things when it comes to history. I don't know. I think this is going to be like a minor tangent. I just feel like when it comes to, all right, people that are actually like that know history might say that even this statement is wrong, but history has some level of truths to it. I mean, things happened. Obviously, the way that it would get recorded, I mean, all those different things are going to impact like what people know about history. So I don't know. I just feel if I ever tried to like think about it or touch that I would wind up just failing so miserably. That's why I stick. That's why I stick. That's why I stick to fiction. That's why I like to read.
I'll tell you one little secret about me and historical games that I work on is that if you ever look at the historical, specifically historical games that I've designed, war games, etc., what you'll note, there's a common theme. You'll note they're all about these like really obscure topics, right? Like I don't ever do like strategic level popular topics of history and war gaming. And that's because I don't want anybody to call me out and tell me like I'm totally wrong. So I'm just like, oh, I'll just pick something obscure that nobody knows anything about, and they no one will be able to call me out on it. So.
Well, I mean, it's I'm not saying that I don't believe that, but
It's
I'm saying
true. No, I mean, it's kind of true. Like I'm not totally joking, right? I mean, it's a little bit. It's fortuitous because I also really love digging into silly, like crazy, like human torpedo riders. Like how insane is that? So I genuinely like it. But I mean, there is a little element of truth to like, if I'm gonna design, if I was to design a game about, whatever, the Eastern Front in World War II, well, Jesus, like, half of the war game playing community knows more about it than I do, right? So that's an intimidating thing to get into. So I mean, I say it in jest, but there is some truth to it.
And it's just a, I mean, it is a really neat idea too. I mean, you like you said, it's something that you're passionate about, kind of digging to find these stories and bring them to light. And me who will read, the rule book or the companion book and wants to read more about it, it's just, I don't know. I'm a big fan of it as someone who is definitely will never, well, I'm not a self-proclaimed history buff by any point, at by any stretch of imagination. Maybe some point I'll be able to kick back and read more there. But I say kick back. I don't know why I said that. I feel like I would if I was reading that stuff, it would be the exact opposite. I'd be like completely like at the edge of my seat. But nice. Okay. So here's kind of like a little bit, and doesn't have to even leave the Valiant Defense series too much, but can kind of transition to like a final conversational topic before getting to, the end. But having had played three of those games and having played some of your Undaunted games, and also knowing that Undaunted came before War Chest, and also having War Chest having expansions and stuff like that too. So I guess the first question that I have is how do you go about the process of thinking of iterations? I mean, you kind of talked about with I think it was Callisto, or at least having that whole group there being very intentional from the start. So that's something that's going on now. But like the Valiant Defense series, each game has, they have so many differences to it, but there are still similar ways in which they play, like through the deck and everything like that. Or I mean, you know what I mean. They're not that similar, but
Yeah,
they
no,
share
but
similarities.
they share a core system for sure. Yeah.
So I guess, at this point, especially with, Undaunted kind of always being on your mind, how has your approach to iteration changed, and at kind of, at what point do you think about, expansions as opposed to iterations? I don't know if that's the best kind of like follow-up or dual question, but
No, I think that's great. I think that's great. I mean, certainly there is a difference, right? So War Chest is a game with expansions. Undaunted, Valiant Defense, etc. is a game with whatever you want to call that, standalone sequels, right? Whatever you want to call that thing of their each game is different, but shares a system. There's pros and cons to both approaches. I think it's probably more interesting. Like the expansion thing, it is what it is, right? Like we're going to create more content for the base game. It doesn't change the base game, etc. So that's kind of it is what it is. In the world of like systems, and this is true of Valiant Defense, this is true of Undaunted, I would say that the designer has a very difficult job of trying to walk the fine line between. There's a reason that you're making another game in the system. The first one must have been successful enough to for you to make a second one. Okay. So you can't deviate too much from the first one because obviously that's what people want, right? If they're buying Undaunted Normandy, or if they're buying Undaunted North Africa, maybe that's their first one, but probably, they're coming from a place where they played Undaunted Normandy. And so clearly you need to make something that it's close enough to the first one that they enjoy it. But it needs to be different enough that there's a reason to own it. Slash, it needs to be different enough that Trevor and I don't lose our minds while we're designing it. And that's it. I'm not, and like, I say that, but I'm not joking. Like, so we are very, so let's, I'll just talk, I'll just dive into Undaunted a little bit more rather than Valiant Defense as I walk through some of these examples. So, you think about Undaunted Normandy, it's the first, fine. Undaunted North Africa was it was interesting because we designed it before Normandy was released. So Osprey said, "Hey, we believe in this game. We want you to design a sequel for it before the first one even comes out." So we had this sort of unenviable task of designing a sequel without having a clue how the game was going to be received, what people are going to like, dislike, etc. And the only guidance that Osprey gave us was just use different nationalities. Okay, so we can do whatever we want, which is not necessarily always good. You can, the sky's the limit. But we quickly settled on, well, we're designing in 2018, I guess it was 19, something like that. And so it's like, well, people like asymmetric stuff, so let's make the sides radically asymmetric in terms of like what they're trying to achieve and et cetera, et cetera. So you're trying to say, let's stay within the system, but do that. And then, of course, reinforcements comes out, and we know that people want solo, so we include solo and team, and we give more of the same. And then, it's Stalingrad comes out, and it's like Osprey told us they were like, we want you to make a legacy game. And when they said that, they actually meant Destructive Legacy, because if you think about that time frame, Destructive Legacy was like all the rage, right? And so, thank God, we were able to like walk that back and make it a resettable campaign, but. Some of it is organic. And so what I mean by that is like Osprey says we want it to be Destructive Legacy. And so that we're like, okay, if we're in an Undaunted world and we're in World War II, if you're going to have a legacy system with a unit size that's small, that small number of people, it's going to have to be in a relatively static environment. So that leads you to Stalingrad. And so Stalingrad kind of, once you've made the decision, you're going to put it there. Stalingrad sort of constrains what's the art of the possible in terms of being in the game. And so all of these things kind of feed back on one another, and the design sort of is informed by the constraints. And then once you've made the decision on the design, it kind of it's just this loop. And then there's a deliberate decision sometimes. When we were done with Stalingrad, we wanted to do something very, very, very different. Again, both for our sanity, for the design challenge of how far can we push the system, for our sanity, because we needed to design something different at that point. And just, to give the players something that felt different. So that's how Battle of Britain came about. So every one of them, I would say that like every discussion for every game is a, it's a game, it's a discussion that takes place in its time and place. It's informed by what's going on at that point in time. But there are some practical issues. We need to move the game in a new direction. It can't just feel like we're phoning it in with like a reskin and doing the same old thing. But again, going back to the very first thing, it still, no matter what, has to still be undaunted, quote unquote undaunted. It has to be that deck builder that has the tempo control and the integrated health and command cards and that kind of stuff, right? So can never deviate too much from that. That was a long-winded answer. I hope I hit on it, but there is no one single thing. It's a lot of different pieces that goes into that decision.
Yeah, no, that answered everything and more. And if you couldn't tell by like the me trying to struggle with the words for the question in the first place, and you somehow answered a question that I didn't even ask in there perfectly. So
That's great.
this is just a maybe clarification for me and potential audience as well. But when does Do you know when Callisto's official release is?
Fall
Okay.
24. I don't think they have it. I don't know if they have an actual date. I hope, I've got my fingers crossed for people listening. I hope that it will be present it's in some form at Gen Con, potentially available for sale. That's my hope. But I think broad release will be, fall of 24. I think every Undaunted game for the past like 5 years has been available around the summer fall timeframe. And of course, I mean it's convention season, right? That's when they're going to want it to release. So.
Well, okay. You don't have to answer this one. I'm not trying to get insider information. So if you say pass, I'll be okay with it. But how many more Undaunted games are you and Trevor currently kicking around?
Oh man. Well, okay. So Callisto's done. We finished the design. Osprey is awesome. Absolutely awesome to work with. And the reason they're awesome to work with is because they run an extremely tight schedule that they hold us to and they hold themselves to. And they're really the only publisher that I know of that is so vigilant about their schedule. And so Trevor and I usually have to finish about, I don't know, a year and a half, 2 years before a game's going to come out, something like that. I don't know, give or take. And so what that means is we finished with Callisto a long time ago. Like we have not worked on Callisto from a design perspective in a long time. I mean, we've checked files and that kind of stuff, but as far as the actual design. So I'm gonna get in trouble, man.
You can say pass. I don't want you to get in trouble.
I will say this. We've worked on a couple since then. So we've worked on a couple since finishing Callisto.
Okay, cool. Well, yeah, I mean, if that's kind of
And
the schedule that you're running, I mean, that makes sense.
I will tell everybody that's listening, if any Undaunteds don't come out after if Callisto's the last one, it's because of this podcast. I got in trouble and they were all canceled. So.
Yeah, when then as small of a podcast as this is, that's going to get canceled too. Everyone's going to bring out their pitchfork, be like, "This is the guy who canceled Undaunted." Well, okay. I mean, well, I'll try to like save myself a little bit. I think people have to know that there's more. That's all I'm going to say. Well, that's funny. Okay. Well, I think in terms of kind of integrating a lot of collaboration, ideas of abstraction at different times, and then your like really great answer to the idea of sequels or iteration systems and the process behind that as well. I mean, you've answered everything and then some. I had some follow-up questions that were random. Worked or didn't work, but I learned a lot, and I have to leave you then with the two kind of wrap-up questions, which are, well, I'll get you with the first one. And the first one is the now ever-present penultimate question, and that's what is a text that has been stuck on your mind? Any text.
Oh, this is funny because I heard I listened to Trevor struggle with this, and then I didn't prepare an answer. This is amazing. Okay. Man. Okay, I'll just talk about this. So I'm in the life. So my church, we have life, what we call life groups, which are people that you go to church with and you get together with and you talk and about whatever you're studying at the time, usually something biblical related. And whether you're religious or not, this is applicable. One of the things that I really took away from the recent life study I was reading about was this sense of people putting too much of themselves, like too much of their identity in things, right? And when you're reading the book suggests like you should be putting your identity in your faith with God. But independent of that, even if you're a secular person, the point of it is to not associate yourself too strongly with any one thing, because if something happens to that one thing, too much of yourself is crushed. So as I was reading that, I was like, man, that makes sense on so many levels, you know, whether you're a parent whose entire world is about their children or whatever it is. And I was recently talking to Liz about this very topic, about a friend of ours who had put a lot of whatever you want to call it, eggs in one basket or whatever of their identity. And so that text, and I'm looking over to hoping that I see the author's on the, but I don't have the book handy. So I can't tell you even who the author was or the book. But just that thought resonated with me, of this sense of making sure that, you know, your sense of self should not be wrapped up in material things that can just be taken away at, you know, at a whim or whatever. So that was something that resonated with me.
Yeah, that's a very like good and profound thought. And then I was like slightly jokingly thinking in my head, good thing nobody can see like the room that I'm currently sitting in. But no, in all sincerity, now that is like a very poignant thought, and just being able to, you know, have different relationships, have different things that you care about to like really have a well-rounded identity.
Yeah, exactly.
I like that. Okay, so then the final question is, we've brought up, I think, in some capacity, these three, but you know, Callisto sometime this year, the Nightfall expansion for War Chest. I think last episode Trevor said it was starting to get delivered,
Yep, that's right.
which is awesome, and then Night Witches this year as well.
No,
Oh,
so
sorry. Oh, sorry.
I think Night Witches will probably like go to Kickstarter. So realistically,
Oh,
I mean,
okay,
who knows? But I think realistically, Night Witches will go to Kickstarter this year and probably like ship next year. You know, I know. I think I don't. You know what? When you talk to Liz, I don't think this was public information. So Ian O'Toole is the artist for Night Witches, and he's just starting on the art now. So I think it's unrealistic to think that it could get. Art can be done and blah, blah, blah. I don't think that's possible. So, yeah, I would think it'd be a 2025 release.
okay. Yeah, I could have probably looked, I could have probably seen or see what like Board Game Geek had to say about that. Well, nonetheless, so Callisto 24 and the Nightfall expansion out. Other things too, and obviously hope sometime soon a Kickstarter for Night Witches as well. But what other things should people be on the lookout for from you?
So I'll mention two because two have been publicly announced. So one is a game that's coming out later this year from another game from Osprey, other than Callisto. It's called War Story: Occupied France. This is a game that is being designed with Dave Neal. So For astute listeners from the last two episodes, you'll realize that Trevor and I work with a lot of people from Cambridge. So this is yet another person. So this is Dave Neal, who worked on Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective, some of the unlocks, etc. So he's extremely well known for his narrative work. And Dave reached out to me and said, "Hey, what do you think about this idea of combining his bailiwick, which is, narrative games, with my thing, which are sort of like this hybrid cross, between hobby and war game space?" And so what we came up with this was this game, this War Story Occupied France. And so it's sort of this, like, I don't want to call it choose your own adventure because it's not really that, but it's sort of from cut from that same cloth, but imagine with a much more interesting combat resolution system when combat's necessary in the game. And so I'm super happy, super excited with that. I think it'll be available at Spiel, I think is when War Story Occupied France comes out. So I'll mention that. The other one, and we mentioned Jeff Engelstein earlier. So the game I'm doing with Jeff is coming out from GMT. It's on their P500. For people that don't know, GMT and P500 is their pre-order system. It's called Cheng He. So it's about the Ming voyages. It probably will be 2025. There, it's in art right now. And the thing that I will say about Ming voyages, Zheng He and the Ming voyages, is I would like to start doing more non-war historical game design. So Zheng He was the first one that I sort of dipped my toes in that is not, a lot of people will say, a lot of people will say that nothing I've designed is a war game. There's a whole like grognard community that would say I've never actually made a war game, and that's fine, I don't really care. But most of my games have at least have a war theme, right? Like that's the thing you're doing is some sort of conflict thing. But I would like to start doing more games that are like adjacent to that space that are more historical focused without that war theme. Not saying I'm leaving war games, but it's just something I would like to explore more. And so Zheng He was is the first one to kind of visit that space. The game that Liz and I are just now starting to work on, that started to design, well, we've been working on it for a few months now, is another game that I would say fits in that space of like sort of war adjacent historical game first and foremost. So hopefully it's not something that I feel super comfortable in quite yet, but I'm definitely interested in exploring it more.
Oh, that's awesome. And I don't know. I was like looking behind at my collection, like I already had it, but you mentioned Zheng He, and as soon as I heard about that, that was an instant P500 for me. I think it's like my very first P500 as well. But
Oh, thank you very much.
no, thank you for getting me introduced to that system and getting me in trouble. And speaking of trouble, and thank you, like once this gets published and my podcast gets canceled for getting you in trouble, that's just going to be
We're going down together.
Yeah, all right. Well, I couldn't have asked for a better final guest.
We've got no, that's not true. You'll have a few more episodes before it all catches up to us and everything goes bad. So who knows? Who knows will be the final guest, but we don't have much longer. Our time is short now.
Well, no, thank you so much for coming on, talking to me, and having all these like really insightful thoughts that have me thinking. And per usual, by the end of the episode, my brain is broken to the point where I come up with questions that aren't questions, and you still answer them nonetheless. So I couldn't be much more appreciative. I'm not. I couldn't be more appreciative. Not much more.
No, I appreciate it. This has been awesome. I really appreciate it. And I'm sad that I have to admit that I discovered your podcast when you reached out. Well, that's not true. Trevor had told me that he was on, and so I kind of knew about it. But I l often lament, like I'm a huge podcast consumer, huge podcast. Like I listen to podcasts all the time, and I always lament the fact that, and I don't know if you share the same frustration. Podcasts are notoriously difficult to find. Like there's no way to like go and like maybe there is and I don't know how to do it. But to just like go and look for how do I find a new podcast, right? Like just you have to kind of know and be told about it. And so when I just quote unquote discovered you, a few weeks back, I've been listening to a ton of your stuff and I really appreciate what you're doing. So thanks for having me on. It was really cool.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I think my title sticks out, which is cool, but well, not to get too down that rabbit hole, I'm not like the biggest like media person in terms of like social media or things like that. So, you know, the best thing that I can do is have like really awesome guests on and have them save me
Yeah,
every single
you can,
episode.
and you can have me on too. You can have Oh
But no,
no, it's been great. I've really enjoyed being able to go back. I mean, that's the one benefit of like coming into it 17, 18 now episodes in, is that like I get 18 episodes I can go back and listen to. So it's been really fun.
I appreciate all levels of support and you being here with me today. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Intertextual Cardboard Experience, the most
Iterative.
podcast about board games and any other text that they connect to. Thank you so much for choosing to spend your time here. Any further support, such as sharing the show with friends, following the page's socials in the episode description, writing a review, filling out the feedback form, or doing anything else you can think of is greatly appreciated. Keep playing, watching, reading, listening, experiencing.